Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The uncertainty of what lies ahead for immigrants in our country is reaching crescendo proportions with the election of Donald Trump. How his immigration policies will unfold is unclear. The nonprofit, the Migrant and Immigrant Community Action Project, or MICA, is here to help. It works with mostly indigent immigrants and refugees, helping them confront legal challenges they may and do face in remaining in this country or in becoming citizens. Joining me in studio are Katie Herbert Meyer, Program Coordinator and Supervising Attorney for MICA. Stephen Legomski is Professor Emeritus at Washington University Law School. He's former Chief Counsel at the Department of Homeland Security's U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and he is a member of the MICA Board. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Katie, let me begin with you. How much fear is there out there?
There is a lot of fear right now. Since the election, starting the day after the election, our phones have been ringing off the hook, and a lot of people are just very afraid about what the future holds for them and for their families.
Right. And, you know, I've read over the weekend that a couple of things have happened. A number of churches across the country are preparing sanctuary facilities, if you will. And oddly enough, the website dictionary.com has cited xenophobia as the word of the year. Xenophobia, of course, meaning distrust and hate even of the other.
Yes, this has been a very worrisome national trend. I think some of the campaign rhetoric may have exacerbated some of the fears that Katie has just described. The word sanctuary tends to mean different things to different people. Sometimes it means we're simply not going to use our cities or our municipalities' resources to enforce the immigration laws because other priorities are higher. Other times it means simply providing a safe space.
Mm. Well, all of this is due to unfold. Katie, as you've indicated, there's a lot of fear out there. Who typically are the people who come to you, your clients?
Sure. Our clients are often families, mixed families, where some of the family members are U.S. citizens and others are foreign-born. Our clients are sometimes refugees or asylum seekers who have fled their countries due to persecution and a fear of return. Our clients sometimes have lawful permanent resident status, what we call a green card, and are looking to apply for citizenship. Some of our clients have been victims of crimes, immigrant victims of crimes, mm-hmm. including victims of domestic violence. So we see a wide variety of clients, but all of them do seem to be uncertain right now as to what the future holds.
You had mentioned just before going on the air, and I was really quite startled to hear this, that a number of foreign-born veterans are also in some jeopardy or could be.
Sure, sure. Although there are some special legal protections for individuals who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces, in general, the deportation laws of the United States do include even those who have served in the Army. And U.S. immigration law right now takes a very strict stance on criminal laws, and Steve could talk more on this, but even minor criminal convictions could make someone deportable. And there's an organization in California that has recently been researching how many vets have been deported based on minor criminal convictions. And they've so far identified over 70 veterans who were deported after serving in the U.S. Armed Forces for minor criminal convictions.
People who've served their country, obviously, Steve. Go ahead.
And Don, could I just add a word to what Katie has said about her client base? She serves some of the most needy and deserving clients one can imagine. Many of them are women and girls, including very young girls, who have been victims of the vilest and cruelest forms of human trafficking. Many are young kids who have been recruited by gangs in Central America and who, despite death threats, have stood up to those gangs and have had the moral fortitude to say, no, I'm not going to join you, but who know that once they make that decision, they can no longer remain safely at home and who fear being returned home. And many are families that have lived in the U.S. for a long time and they fear being split up. Some are women who have been subjected to really grotesque domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So the clients she serves are extremely important.
Yeah. Those people who are anti-immigrant in the country today tend to lose sight of the fact that I think it's there's a misnomer or misconception that we're talking about people who are coming over the border maybe as farm workers and taking jobs away from Americans. It's a whole different dynamic out there.
Yeah, the economists are not entirely in consensus, but one thing they seem to agree on is that immigrants not only take jobs, which is something we can see, but also create jobs in the same way that all of us do by consuming goods and services. And it's really not at all clear whether the number of jobs immigrants take is any greater than the number they create. In addition to that, they provide for economic growth in certain sectors that really need their labor.
And Steve, I think Don brings up a good point, though, that at least the calls we are receiving many more calls of people who are fleeing due to violence, and many more individuals coming from countries in Central America and fewer from Mexico. I do think that while there are still economic migrants who are coming into the country, the large numbers we've been seeing have been people fleeing just unspeakable violence, violence that they've lived with for their whole lives and has become routine to them, but is just very difficult to hear.
I understand what you're saying, Katie, about the fear that's out there. But deportation is nothing new. During the Obama administration, hundreds of thousands of people have been deported. It's a process that what I'm reading is likely just to continue.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I don't expect deportations to slow down at all. There is certainly talk that the incoming administration will, in fact, try to increase deportations. I mean, we as an organization will just continue to walk with our clients and to pursue every possible avenue of relief under the legal system. Although our deportation system lacks some discretion, then that could help it be more just and more fair. There are some limited forms of relief that we can help people apply for to help them stay safely in the United States.
Yeah, and can I just add that it is true that the deportation numbers or the removal numbers under the Obama administration have seemed high. It's important to remember, though, that the vast majority of the people who are listed as removed are people who are apprehended at the border and who are then sent back, as opposed to the less humane alternative of deporting people from the interior. The administration has felt that this makes good sense because with limited resources, it's much smarter to apprehend somebody at the border than to divert resources from the border, wait several years, and then try to hunt them down when they're harder to find and costlier to deport.
Is this something that we should be doing as a country? I mean, deporting those who fall into the categories that we've been talking about?
Well, people have different views about this. I think, to be fair, a country does have to respect the rule of law and does have certain sovereign interests in maintaining the integrity of its borders. So I think most would agree that it's morally permissible, if not obligatory, to police the border, and that doesn't do any good unless you say that if a person enters illegally, they are at least subject to deportation. Mm-hmm. I think where the real debate has been is whom do we deport, how many, and how important is it to remove a person who has been here unlawfully compared to the interest that person has accrued by virtue of having lived here so long?
Katie, on the basis of what we know, what do you anticipate from the Trump administration that would be really different from what's going on now?
It's a lot of speculation at this point, obviously, but one of the biggest fears, and I do think something that could happen fairly quickly, is that President-elect Trump will rescind the DACA program that was created by President Obama.
These are the youngsters who have come in. The parents brought them in at a very young age.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And those who had completed high school or a GED and who have very clean records. And they were given – they basically were told, come out of the shadows, apply, give us your name, your address, where you live, and we will give you a reprieve from deportation. Deferred action just means we're going to defer to another day taking action against you. And they were granted permission to work, which for many of them allowed them to go on to college, to get jobs, to continue being productive members of society. And remember, for most of these kids, the United States educational system educated them.
And that's all they know.
That's all they know, yeah. And so there is a real big concern that they've just given their information to an administration that is going to then go seek to deport them, even though they were given a promise that they were given a reprieve from deportation.
In essence, they are registered. I mean, the government knows who they are and where they are for the most part.
There's certainly an argument that it would violate due process for the government to just take that information and go and try to sweep up everyone who has filed for DACA. I don't know whether or not that would hold up in court, but some arguments linking it to entrapment in that it was a program that they were told, you know, give us your information. But certainly there's that fear. And we can't at this point say to our clients or to people who call, oh, there's nothing to be afraid about. Don't worry about it. That fear is out there.
What do you make of that, Steve?
No, I agree with what Katie has said. The question of whether due process would forbid the government from removing people who were asked to give them their addresses is still an open question, as Katie has said. And it's difficult to know how it would come out in court. But I do agree that it would be quite cruel and inhumane to move against that population at this time.
I assume, Katie, that you've had a number of inquiries from the DACA contingent, if you will.
We have.
What can you do for them?
I think so. It depends on the category. For those who already have DACA, we've tried to focus on the positive that youth have permission to work. They're granted permission to work for 2 years. So each individual is going to be a little different based on when they were granted it. But, you know, just to focus on that positive that you have permission to work. And, you know, all we can do is wait and see. If there is an attempt to try to remove you, that we will do everything we can to walk with you and to try to stop that if we can under the law. And for those who haven't yet applied, at this point, we do not think it's a good option to apply now because it's unlikely their application would be adjudicated prior to the new administration coming in. But for those who have it, we are working to renew if they're eligible to renew or just have them maintain it.
What is everything you can do? You say we will do everything we can.
Some of it's going to depend on each individual's case. You know, are they going to meet the criteria for various different forms of relief from deportation? So basically a way to stop deportation. It'll depend on family ties, how long they've been in the country, and just other equities that the judge may be able to consider. Overall, Steve could talk to this in more detail, but immigration judges were stripped of a lot of their discretion over whether or not it just makes sense to deport someone. And the rules have become very black and white.
All right. Do you want to comment, Steve?
Well, yeah, I think Katie is referring mainly to a remedy called cancellation of removal. It used to be until 1996 that a person who had lived in the U.S. for 7 years and who could demonstrate extreme hardship, either to himself or to certain U.S. citizen family members, would be someone whom the immigration judge had the discretion to allow to stay. But in 1996, Congress severely limited the situations in which judges could even consider whether to remove a person. Now you need to show something called exceptional and extremely unusual hardship. And even if you show that to yourself, that is no longer enough. You have to show that some U.S. citizen family member would suffer that kind of hardship.
Do we have any sense of numbers, how many people we're talking about in our region who might fall into these categories?
I don't have any numbers in
hundreds
front of me.
Hundreds or thousands, would you say?
I would imagine thousands. Yeah, more than hundreds, I would say.
All right. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We're talking about an organization, the Migrant and Immigrant Community Action Project, which is here to serve primarily indigent people who have questions about residency here, who might be in the country illegally or not, but who are concerned about what their future holds given the new administration about to take office. Katie Herbert-Meyer is with us. She is with the MICA, and Stephen Legomski also with us. He's a member of the MICA board. Back to continue the conversation in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Katie Meyer and Stephen Legomski about immigration. Katie, back to you with regard to the range of services you provide. Have we covered everything that you can do for these people?
No, it's difficult to cover just in a quick conversation all the different types of cases that we can assist someone with. We provide basically all sorts of immigration legal services that an individual might need, except we do not represent people in filing employment-based immigration cases. Those are cases where an employer would sponsor a non-citizen for either a temporary or a permanent visa. And in most cases, it's the employer's responsibility to obtain counsel and submit those applications.
Most of your clients, I understand, are indigent. Is that a correct classification?
I don't know if all would qualify as indigent. All of our clients are low income and would find it difficult to either impossible or difficult to pay a private attorney. So our clients range anywhere from below the poverty line up to about 250% of the poverty line. And so some of them are that middle income range where they don't qualify for free services from legal aid, but couldn't afford the thousands of dollars it would cost to hire a private attorney.
Thousands of dollars. It's an expensive
It is an expensive process. And that's not because immigration attorneys are greedy. In fact, I think overall immigration attorneys are quite generous with their pro bono time. But these cases often take years. This isn't a matter of something where you go file something at your local courthouse and it's resolved within weeks or months. The application process often takes years.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Can I just add, not only is it a long duration, but also people often don't realize that in order to win an asylum case, no matter how meritorious your claim, no matter how dangerous your situation, if you're not represented by counsel, you have very, very little chance of prevailing. And that's because to win an asylum case, you need to file gobs and gobs of meticulously documented country conditions, your situation, why you were persecuted, and so forth. Right. And people who simply arrive traumatized, without knowing English, without knowing our culture, are seldom in a position to do that on their own. So the services that Katie and her colleagues provide often make the difference, literally, between life and death.
Katie, how many cases would you have ongoing at any given time?
We currently have 379 cases. We just counted since we're nearing.
And four attorneys, is that correct?
We do. We have four attorneys and active 379 cases, yes. Yeah.
The question of asylum has been raised during our discussion here. How would you anticipate this will unfold, the asylum issue will unfold under Trump? Steve?
Sure. That's a little more difficult to say. The criteria for asylum are set by statute, by Congress. Nonetheless, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, if he becomes the Attorney General, has very restrictive views on immigration generally. And the Attorney General does have the power to review and reverse any decision by a board called the Board of Immigration Appeals. This is basically the Supreme Court of immigration law. Their interpretations create binding precedent for immigration judges and others. And so the Attorney General would have the power to drastically restrict the interpretations of who qualifies for asylum and who does not.
Hmm. Well, that's an indication of why this process takes so long.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
Only four attorneys. I mean, that's not very many. How do you fund this whole process?
Sure. Well, I'll start by mentioning we've actually only been around since 2012, so we are still a relatively young organization, and the organization started in 2012 with two attorneys, and we have now grown to four attorneys and a full-time support staff person. We are funded through primarily private funders, so we do get grants from private foundations. We have no federal or state grants. We through the generosity of individual donors, and then we do charge our clients, those who can afford it, a reduced legal fee. They pay on a sliding scale. So a small percentage of our budget is funded by client direct payments, but we increasingly are relying on donors, especially right now as we are getting, unfortunately, many more calls from individuals than we can actually work with. And it just breaks our heart to have to tell people with very sad stories that we can't help them.
Do they find you or do you find them?
The donors or the clients?
Clients.
Clients find us. We do very little advertising, as you might think of, to find clients. Most of our clients find us through a network of other service providers or through word of mouth. Mm-hmm. So the various different other organizations that provide other services to immigrants will often refer clients to us.
Could I tag on to that?
Of Katie course.
I think Katie is too modest to describe how important the work she is doing is. But based on everything that's been said, the clients have tremendous needs that only lawyers can help them effectuate. And all of us are solicited to death, especially this time of year, by various charities, all of which are very good causes, and we try to do what we can. But in this case, by donating to MICA, a person quite literally, I don't think it's too melodramatic to say this, can save the life of a child or a mother. The donor will most likely never meet the child. The child will never know who that savior was. But if you give, you'll know. And I just promise you that if you give that kind of money now, it's an act of kindness you'll never regret.
Yeah.
And I guess you would go to MICA.
Mica-project.org. Yeah. Mica-project.org. Yes. And in fact, it is a great time to give if someone is so inclined. We were just notified by a very generous donor that he is matching all our donations up to $25,000 that we received before the end of the year. And so it would be a great time to have your impact doubled.
We will put a link to your website and to that website on ours at stlpublicradio.org.
Thank you.
I assume that from time to time that some of your clients will come through who are undocumented. What is your responsibility with regard to these folks?
I mean, our responsibility to an undocumented client is the same as any other client. I mean, we will review their case and we will look to see whether they have any sort of avenue to obtain lawful status. And if so, we will, and if we have the capacity within our office to take the case, we will walk with them through all those steps. We don't have any sort of obligation to report anyone to the government. In fact, we have a duty of confidentiality as attorneys that we cannot report someone to the government if they were to call us. So if a potential client calls us, we can reassure them right away that everything you tell us is confidential. We cannot tell anyone anything you've told us about your case.
And Steve, I imagine more than one has come through and come by that way. There are undocumented people in this region, needless to say.
Certainly. The most common scenario is those mixed families that I talked about, where you have one spouse who is a U.S. citizen, native-born U.S. citizen, and one spouse who is undocumented, who either entered the country on a visa, the visa expired and they've stayed, or who surreptitiously entered through the border. And there is really a false belief out there that if you marry a U.S. citizen or even have a U.S. citizen child, you just file some applications, pay some fees, and the foreign-born spouse is able to get status in this country. And for a large percentage of people in that situation, there is no path to getting a green card in this country. And so there is no line to get into. There is no fee to pay. It's not a matter of someone saying, oh, I just don't want to do that now, or I don't have the money. It's the way our legal system is set up. There is no path for them to do that. The spouse can apply for the U.S. citizen spouse, can apply for the foreign-born spouse, but unless they entered lawfully on a visa, they have to leave the country. And when they leave, they're barred for 10 years from returning unless they can get a special waiver. So the process is just, it's difficult, it's lengthy, and it's not one that most people could just go look it up online and navigate themselves.
So we are talking about splitting families here under the right circumstances. A child born in this country of parents who came here illegally, there's a good possibility, probability that if they're deported, the kid would stay or have to go with them.
That's right. Many people have wondered whether it's even constitutional to deport the parents of a U.S. citizen child, because, as you say, the practical result is the child will have to leave. But what the courts have said about this is that the parents have to make choices for their children, and sometimes those choices are unpalatable, but that's where the case law is right now.
Our time is beginning to wind down. What is the takeaway you want people to have from our discussion here today, Katie?
Oh, I mean, I think the takeaway is just to try to understand and look behind the rhetoric of whether someone is here legally or illegally, or, you know, whether they're an immigrant, and look to the humanity behind it. Everyone has a story. And everyone who has come to this country, particularly when they came fleeing something horrific, had to make a very difficult choice to go on a dangerous journey to come to the U.S. or to stay and perhaps face certain death in their country. And I think if we can kind of look to the humanity behind and ask why someone came rather than just judging without knowing the facts.
Any thought you want to leave us with, Steve?
I agree with everything Katie has just said so eloquently. I guess I would add simply that the impact of undocumented immigrants is not the kind of negative impact that the rhetoric sometimes implies. We're talking mainly about people with lots of initiative, a strong work ethic, and a very low crime rate.
In 30 seconds, can you tell me what I can do as a partner or spouse, as a U.S. citizen who is going through this? Of a person who's going through this whole process of concern?
It very much depends on how your spouse entered the country. If she entered the country on a temporary visa and then overstayed, then there might be a route by which she can adjust her status to that of a permanent resident while in the U.S. But if, like a majority of our undocumented population, she became undocumented by entering without inspection in the first place, then there's not a whole lot you can do.
Well, I say call you folks is what you have to do, right?
Exactly.
Thank you both. Katie Meyer, thank you so much for being with us. Steve Legomski, thank you. The Migrant and Immigrant Community Action Project is what we've been talking about. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.